listening to Gossip End, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip End is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today are Caitlin Hopkins, Lara Luthi, and Karen Frost. Caitlin Hopkins is a threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, a Microsoft company. She has a master's degree in applied intelligence and has spent 4 years in analytic positions working for the government and the private sector. Lara Luthi is a senior researcher at Xbox and has extensive experience in the gaming and interactive entertainment industry. Before her move to Microsoft, she worked as an analyst in the federal government for a little over 5 years. Karen Frost is a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. Previously, she spent 11 years working in the federal government, and for the last 6 years, she's also been a freelance pop culture journalist. And I'm Diana Duviel. I'm also a senior threat analyst at RiskIQ, and I spent 10 years as an analyst in the federal government. Although all of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. So for today's structured analytic technique, we have the analysis of competing hypotheses, abbreviated to ACH. Imagine this scenario. Your company's computer network has been breached by some nefarious cyber actor. Oh no, who done it? All your coworkers pile in with their pet ideas about who the culprit is, a competitor trying to steal company secrets, or it's the Chinese or Russians conducting cyber espionage. It's a cyber criminal gang that wants to steal data to extort the company for money. Each of these ideas can be characterized as a competing hypothesis. But how do we analyze these hypotheses or rack and stack them to figure out which one is most likely? We can use ACH. An ACH is a diagnostic structured analytic technique that helps us avoid confirmation bias and highlight key evidence, while also trying to understand which hypothesis out of several is the most likely. The first step is to identify all the hypotheses and get them out there on the table. Brainstorming all these hypotheses is a good way to overcome some biases right off the bat. So for example, perhaps your company has already been breached by Chinese hackers 10 times. Your reflex might be to assume, well, that it's the Chinese again. While that's logical, if you're default to that, you ignore all the other possible options and you're trapping yourself in a mental box. So identifying all the possible hypotheses, on the other hand, pushes you to move past that reflexive snap judgment. It might still be the Chinese, but if it's not, you'll be better positioned to figure out who done it. Next, you make a list of all of the evidence for each hypothesis. So in this scenario, it might be things like the tactics and techniques used by your mystery intruders and other observed data points, like the IP address from which the attack was launched. Imagine this list of evidence forming the leftmost column of a matrix with one piece of evidence per row. And then across the top of the matrix, the column headers, those are all of your potential hypothesis options. Now you begin to work across the matrix in the diagnostic phase. So to do this, you select a piece of evidence and you compare it to each hypothesis, going column by column. So something to note here is that we don't want to prove a hypothesis. What we're trying to do is disprove it. So for example, let's say Russian language is used in the code of the malicious attack. This suggests it's probably not Chinese attackers behind it. False flagging and code artifacts aside, we can probably say that piece of evidence would make it less likely the attackers are Chinese and more likely they have a Russian connection. But we still have to keep going through all the evidence. After that's done, you should take a step back and conduct an initial review of the results. You want to identify any gaps and maybe take some time to collect additional evidence to fill them. It may even be that you have generated a new hypothesis as you've gone through this process. Maybe you need to consider Iran as a source of the hacking, for example. So once all this evaluation is finished, it's time to see which hypotheses match the evidence and which don't. For example, if you see that a lot of the evidence is not consistent with a Chinese threat actor, perhaps you can rule that hypothesis out. Or more precisely, you would say that's the less likely hypothesis. So an ACH is very transparent and audible. It's also a way of really showing your work because at the end of it, you have this matrix that everyone can look at. But it can be time consuming and it can become unwieldy if you have a large number of competing hypotheses or tons of evidence. But it's a good tool to have in your analytic toolkit and it doesn't have to be onerous. So Karen, how could we apply an ACH to gossip?
First of all, it's important to remember that ACHs work best when there are multiple separate, mutually exclusive hypotheses or scenarios. This means that there shouldn't be any overlap between these scenarios. That doesn't mean there can't be gray area in the issue, only that when formulating our ACH, we have to be careful to set up our hypotheses so that we can come up with black and white answers. For example, back in 2014, there was a rumor that the singer Lorde was lying about her age, and that instead of being a teenager, she was actually in her 40s. That's a very black and white scenario. She's either the age she claims to be, or she's not. But what if the situation is more complex? Today's gossip topic has a lot of complexity to it, so we're going to really narrow it down in order to effectively apply the structured analytic technique.
Ooh, so what is that topic?
The question of whether singing sensation Taylor Swift and Victoria's Secret supermodel Karlie Kloss ever dated. This is actually a fantastic example for which to use an ACH because the issue has been extensively debated online. There are entire websites devoted to the topic, and dozens of well-written blogs have been written that discuss this topic. This means the evidence has already been collected for us, and all we have to do is parse through it. I said just now that when dealing with complex issues, we want to simplify our hypotheses as much as possible. In this case, we're specifically not looking at the sexual orientation of either Swift or Kloss. That's because it's largely, but not totally, irrelevant to the way we're going to lay out our evidence. Yes, if either of the women were heterosexual, it would argue against the hypothesis that they dated, but the reverse isn't true. They could both not be heterosexual, and that didn't mean they did date. So again, we're really boiling this issue to one question. Did they or didn't they date? In this case, the answer is yes or no, which means there are only two hypotheses that we'll be considering. But as you showed with your cyber attack example, often an ACH has multiple hypotheses, three or four, for example. The more hypotheses, the harder it will be to ensure they're mutually exclusive. So what you may find is that you start to get more overlap.
So what I'm hearing is that for this example, hypothesis one is that Taylor Swift and Karlie Kloss did date. What's the evidence?
Well, let's start with a little backstory here to get our listeners familiar with the context. Swift and Kloss first publicly interacted in November 2013 at the Victoria's Secret fashion show, and this kicked off a very close relationship between the two. For years, they were such close friends, in fact, that Swift claimed she kept a room in her house in New York City for Kloss, even though they lived really close to each other in New York City. In December 2014, they were attending a concert when a brief video was taken that some fans have claimed shows Swift and Kloss kissing. This sets the stage for our ACH. So hypothesis one is that yes, they dated. This hypothesis doesn't set out to assess the sexual orientation of either woman or how long they might have dated. It only says they dated. So what evidence do people who believe they dated offer? In Swift's song, Dancing with Our Hands Tied, she writes about loving someone in secret at age 25 who painted her golden. This theme is echoed in the very next song on the Reputation album, Dress, which continues the theme of secretly dating, a golden tattoo, and even the line, I don't want you like a best friend. The lyrics clearly state they don't refer to anyone Swift has publicly dated. So who does that leave? Swift was born in December 1989, so when she was 25, the year would have been approximately 2014 or 2015. Reputation came out in November 2017, which means she likely wrote the songs after the release of her previous album, 1989, in 2014. Well, what happened in her life during that time? Luckily, it was a period in which Swift was stalked on an almost daily basis by the paparazzi, so we know a lot about her activities. Enter the first piece of evidence. In 2016, Swift and Kloss wore matching gold tattoos at rapper Drake's birthday party. But we don't even have to be that literal. Kloss, we must emphasize, was Swift's blonde best friend when she was 25. The second piece of evidence is also from a song lyric. In Don't Blame Me, still from the same album, Swift writes, "Halo, hiding my obsession. I once was poison ivy, now I'm your daisy." Kloss, of course, was Victoria's Secret angel when the two met, and they attended the 2014 Victoria's Secret fashion show together. After a trip the two took to Big Sur in March 2014, Kloss posted to Instagram a photo of a daisy on the car dashboard in which the flower is tagged as Swift. In fact, Kloss wore that same daisy in multiple photos from the trip. And in another photo from the trip, Karlie is even writing Karlie Hearts Taylor in the sand. The fourth piece of evidence is from, you guessed it, the same album again. In Delicate, Swift writes, third floor on the west side, me and you, handsome, you're a mansion with a view. Swift has three next door properties in Tribeca, but in 2016, she briefly rented a place at 23 Cornelia Street in Greenwich Village while renovations were happening on her Tribeca properties. What if Swift actually meant West Village? only she had to shift the words to match the syllable count. Who lived less than a mile away during the correct time frame? You guessed it. Between 2012 and 2019, Kloss lived at 181 Charles Street in the West Village. Is it three floors? Yes. It's listed as a three level, although technically one level is the basement. Swift's temporary place she was renting was also three stories. In fact, the whole of the Reputation album is about a beautiful golden lover with blue eyes who can be seen but not touched when in public. We see this in the lyrics of Gorgeous and Gold Rush as well. And Kloss, conveniently, is not only a beautiful blonde model, but she has blue eyes. As the fifth and final piece of evidence, when performing New Year's Day at the Time 100 Gala in 2019, Swift changed the lyrics in the song from "I want your midnights" to "I want her midnights" twice. It's very clear when you listen. This song is the final track on the Reputation album, suggesting the song may have originally been written about a female. Now, at the end of 2017, something appears to have gone wrong between Swift and Kloss. Whether they were friends or more than friends, at any rate, the relationship soured. And then in October 2018, Kloss married Josh Kushner. So ends hypothesis one. Hypothesis two, of course, is that the two didn't date. So what evidence do we have here? The big thing is that all the evidence in hypothesis one is based on making assumptions about secret or implied meanings of song lyrics. But we have a problem. While Swift's early albums were all allegedly linked directly to her dating history, recently Swift said her songs aren't necessarily about real people. For her most recent album, Folklore, for example, she says the stories are from the perspective of people she's never met, people she knows, or those she wishes she hadn't met. So if this is true of the current album, may it also be true of at least some of the songs on past albums? The second piece of evidence involves Kloss's now husband, Josh Kushner. Kloss and Kushner have been dating since 2012. For us to believe that Swift and Kloss were in a relationship, we have to assume that either the Kloss-Kushner relationship was fake, or that it was an open relationship, or that Kloss was cheating. In fact, Kushner was at the concert where some fans thought Swift and Kloss kissed. The third piece of evidence comes from Swift herself. During Swift's secret sessions, which are intimate events at which Swift invites fans to hear upcoming albums before their release, she told fans that many of the songs on Reputation were about actor Joe Alwyn, who she had been publicly dating for a year at that point. Alwyn is also blonde with blue eyes. Of course, some of the songs could also have been about Calvin Harris, who she publicly dated between 2015 and 2016, or even her flash in the pan public relationship with Tom Hiddleston in the summer of 2016, both of whom were kind of blonde at the time with blue eyes. Although last week we learned about the idea of fake relationships, what are the odds that all of Swift's relationships at this time were fake or open, or that she was cheating on them? Having arrayed the evidence, I leave it to listeners to decide which hypothesis sounds the most valid. Did Swift write an entire album about a secret relationship with her female best friend during a time in which she was publicly dating famous men to provide cover? Or did she either have a secret male lover during some of that time or invent one? Rather than using an ACH for this issue, we could also have used a Team A, Team B approach, or even devil's advocacy, two other structured analytic techniques that we'll discuss later in this podcast. I just want to say one final thing about an ACH framework. The structured analytic technique is intended to help us overcome things like confirmation bias, but we also want to be careful that we're properly weighing the evidence. Let's say we had two hypotheses and one hypothesis had a boatload of evidence, while the second had almost none. It might seem at first glance as though the first hypothesis is the more credible one, but we may find that if we weight each piece of evidence, for example, on a scale of 1 to 3, we'd find that in fact, hypothesis 2 is more credible. So an ACH isn't just about laying out all your evidence and seeing which hypothesis has more. It's about understanding how important or significant that evidence is as well.
Fascinating. So could we apply an ACH to a tech topic as well?
Most definitely. And today we'll apply it to tech billionaire Elon Musk and his desire to colonize Mars. This is another great example in which we can use an ACH because the issue has been widely discussed online and by Musk himself. If you're not familiar with the topic, here's a little background. In 2001, Musk had the idea of sending life the furthest it's ever traveled by landing a mini greenhouse kitted out with plants growing in a dehydrated nutrient gel to Mars. He called this plan Mars Oasis. But after many attempts, Musk and his team were unable to find a rocket cheap enough and reliable enough to bring Mars Oasis to fruition. Space travel was still prohibitively expensive, even to a billionaire. So Musk redirected, making his new immediate goal to improve rocket technology and his company Space Exploration Technologies Corp, or SpaceX, was born. Since then, Musk's plan for SpaceX has gotten more and more ambitious, and he started to announce aspirations to establish a fully self-sustaining colony on Mars, mainly to ensure that humanity is not a single planet species.
Thanks, Caitlin. When it comes to tech billionaires and their exploits, it can seem nearly impossible to separate the man from the mystery. I think this is especially the case with the mercurial Musk, but it's also why Musk's personal mission to colonize Mars is an ideal example for ACH, because as Karen mentioned, there are so many hypotheses we could derive from this example. And Musk's personal motivations are often the most difficult to decipher and the easiest to gossip about and fall into bias traps like historical bias, confirmation bias, and the like.
Okay, so what hypotheses could you draw from that topic to begin constructing an ACH?
Hypothesis one could be that Musk's motivations for transplanting human life to Mars lie in a form of humanism or altruism. Conversely, hypothesis two could be that Elon's motivations are financial, whether they either started out that way or evolved there. But unlike Karen's pop culture ACH example, these two hypotheses are a bit less mutually exclusive. However, they still do work to further examine the issue.
Interesting. So, Laura, what evidence exists to support that Musk's motivations are philanthropic?
Well, first, we can look at what Musk himself has said about traveling to and colonizing Mars. In talks and interviews, he has made very idealistic public statements about it. Musk has said he wants to create, quote, life insurance for life as a whole, and that being a spacefaring species is about believing in the future and thinking that the future will be better than the past. He has also made many other romantic statements about what life on Mars could look like, saying that the people of Mars could rethink society, to hopefully become more enlightened, presumably, than we are now. Government could even be rethought to be more direct rather than representative. Technically, a true democracy rather than a republic. Another way to describe Musk's approach is to call it expeditionary. During a 2018 interview with The Guardian, Musk denied that Mars might be some escape hatch for rich people by highlighting the risks of the mission, comparing it to Shackleton's ad for Antarctic explorers back in the day: difficult, dangerous, a good chance you'll die, excitement for those who survive. Sounds a bit like a Star Trek episode to me. He also has expressed his fear of unregulated AI and made pretty controversial statements about AI taking over human society, with his more mild concern being with unchecked or unregulated AI algorithms. He may feel that he is creating Mars as a last escape refuge for humanity when the algorithms take over.
That definitely sounds like he's in it for the ideals and not the money. So why might it actually be about financial motivations? Caitlin, what evidence do you have to support that Elon sees Mars travel as a way to make money and attract investors?
So the goal of building, manning, and then maintaining a Mars colony, that includes terraforming and building new tech to build and send structures for life on Mars. This will likely take massive amounts of capital that Musk just doesn't have. Mankind hasn't even been back to walk on the moon since 1972. But when we talk about colonizing Mars, it reads more like a sci-fi novel than real life. So let's look at what Elon Musk is actually doing right now and why that might indicate his motives aren't exactly what he claims. The first piece of evidence is how SpaceX's business model is evolving to include private space travel. Yes, one could argue that somehow this helps test rocket payloads and aerodynamics. Then again, couldn't that have just been done using NASA-sponsored flights? In this case, we could say that other than potentially building, I don't know, public interest in spaceflight, this likely doesn't have any overarching philanthropic purpose. In essence, Musk is commercializing spaceflight for the upper class, just like sci-fi movies always claimed would happen. And to add a little to that, in April, a SpaceX rocket took four passengers to the International Space Station. It cost approximately $120 million for SpaceX, while the passengers were estimated to have paid about $55 million each. This means that SpaceX made approximately $100 million off the flight. As the cost of rocket launches goes down, that profit margin should continue to grow. And Musk claims that his Starship rocket will cost less than $10 million to launch. and demand for this commercial spaceflight is definitely there. Already, Virgin Galactic has about 700 seats reserved between now and 2025 alone. So the second piece of evidence is that Musk's projects, including the mission to Mars, always claim to be revolutionary, and that gets them free money from the US government. In April 2021, for example, NASA awarded SpaceX a $2.89 billion contract to work on landing commercial humans on the moon. So as long as Musk continues to promise big ideas, the US government continues to subsidize them. And the third piece of evidence is less a solid data point and more of a general point. Musk's influence as a visionary and his success with SpaceX and Tesla have garnered him quite a following and a reputation as a futurist. Musk has been influential in driving interest in things like cryptocurrency. This influence lends itself to more of a financial gain for him. For example, he bought Dogecoin and then tweeted about it. And this caused fans to buy Dogecoin, driving its price way up. And by talking about colonizing Mars, even if we can't directly see the financial gain, there could still be things that we don't see on the surface that benefit him financially. And before we wrap up, I just want to note that there are definitely some large information gaps that we're combating with this topic, especially with this particular hypothesis. Because SpaceX is a private company, we have very little insight to see its financials. We don't know how much revenue the company is generating from different projects or where that money is being reinvested. Being aware of and talking through these information gaps will only improve our analysis.
And I'd like to add one more thing, which is hypothesis three. We know Musk sees himself as a real-life Iron Man and uses talk about things like colonizing Mars to boost his public image. And we've talked before about how Musk has integrated himself into the Hollywood scene. He loves the limelight. What if the Mars idea in particular is intended to draw publicity to himself and his personal relationship with technology, even as he knows the colonization of Mars is impossible for at least a century more? He gets free publicity without having to put the resources and risk into landing something on the red planet. So his gain isn't financial, it's reputational. I think that's also possibly a third hypothesis. One of the problems with doing an ACH on this, as you noted, Caitlin, is that we're trying to get into what is, in essence, secret information, but inaccessible information. Musk is the one who owns this information, and it can be different from what he even tells his business partners. So us from the outside trying to get an idea, we're really just trying to look at what is being done and make inferences. But again, we don't have any other option. So in this case, the answer that we come up with is likely to be very vague, and it's likely not going to be 100% correct. But if we can develop a bunch of evidence over time, we might be able to zero in more accurately on this type of topic. Later, we'll talk about the difficulty of understanding people's intentions from the outside. It's doable. It's just a lot more difficult.
The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called deception detection. Actor Jussie Smollett was convicted of staging a hate crime. What method could law enforcement have used to identify his lie? And then on the tech side, we'll be discussing Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. Find out all this and more on the next episode of Gossip Int.